Merci beaucoup Alain. Nous avons commencé avec 10 minutes de retard, nous sommes parfaitement dans les temps et je vous en remercie. Sans plus tarder, je vais présenter le second intervenant. Nous restons dans le Nord, n'est-ce pas, selon la parité que j'ai annoncée au début de la journée, avec Dupree Williams, qui est un archéologue et un historien de l'art, qui a eu la chance et le privilège d'être le conservateur en chef des collections grecques et romaines du British Museum, donc vraiment un trésor des trésors, et qui est depuis quelques années directeur de recherche au Centre de recherche en archéologie et patrimoine à l'Université libre de Bruxelles. Un historien de l'art, un archéologue qui a publié sur les antiquités dont il avait la charge. Un de ses livres s'appelle « The Parthenon Sculptures, Cleaning and Controversy »,« Nettoyage et controverse autour des sculptures du Parthenon. Il est l'auteur aussi des Masterpieces of Classical Art, des chefs-d'œuvre de l'art classique, et The Aegina Treasure, Aegean Bronze Jewelry and a Mystery Revisited, un ouvrage sur le trésor d'Égine et la reconsidération d'un mystère. C'est un grand spécialiste des vases grecs, du Parthénon lui-même, et notamment de ses frises et de ses sculptures. Et c'est un des premiers spécialistes du domaine, et c'est pourquoi il m'est particulièrement cher, à s'être penché sur la dimension locale des acquisitions de Lord Elgin en Grèce et à Constantinople, à la fois pour ce qui est des sarcophages d'empereurs byzantins, et bien sûr, les éléments architecturaux et décoratifs du Parthénon. C'est donc avec beaucoup de plaisir et d'honneur que j'invite Dupree Williams à présenter son intervention sur les musulmans, les Raya étant le nom que l'on donne au XIXe siècle aux sujets ottomans non musulmans, et francs, les francs étant bien sûr les Européens dans ce même contexte, et des réactions à Lord Elgin et ses artistes.
Thank you very
much. Je rappelle que vous avez la traduction simultanée si vous servez de votre casque.
Thank you very much indeed, Adam, and thank you so much for inviting me here and giving me the chance to meet you and your colleagues. I only regret that this entails me producing a paper for you today. I must also apologize for speaking in English. That is painful for you, I know, but I assure you it would be more painful if I spoke French. In many ways, the world and our story begins with Napoleon and his conquest of Egypt, his attack in 1798, his seizure of Cairo. But Horatio Nelson was not far behind, and he defeated the French fleet and changed the balance of power. And what we talk about the whole of today in this sort of period, in this sort of area, and certainly for the sculptures of the Parthenon, we are talking about that change of policy which allowed the British to hold sway in Constantinople, whereas previously, and in a sense habitually, it had been the French who had held power. And it's against this background that Lord Elgin was appointed ambassador in 1798. And I will take you through some of the history, because if I concentrated just on the local voices, we would be out of here in 2 minutes. That's the scale of the discrepancy. So I will set the history for you so you can begin to judge not only the local voices, but also the actions and other voices. I begin in the Dardanelles, Elgin arriving in his boat with his entourage is held there by bad weather, isn't everybody, or wasn't everybody. There, waiting for him, I think, was the Capitan Pasha, the admiral of the fleet, of the Ottoman fleet. And this was to meet this new representative of Britain in a new context in which the Ottoman port wanted to have considerable influence because they wanted to drive the French out of Egypt. Egypt was theirs, and this must be stopped. So Britain was this ally, and Elgin was the person they had to go to and wanted to encourage. And we see, quite extraordinarily, from the letters of Lord Elgin and his wife, Lady Elgin, the contact, even at this first moment, with the Ottomans. And I'll concentrate first on these Ottomans in Constantinople, because in a sense, this is a voice which sets everything in motion. We know a fair amount about Captain Pasha and his actions. He was a very close associate of the Sultan. He was probably, as was most of the port, French orientated, but was clearly willing to have a connection with the English. He was accompanied by someone who was called his confidential secretary, Isaac Bey. In beginning to look at these sorts of issues and voices, it's very difficult to work out who was who. And Isaac Bey becomes a figure, but what do we actually know of him? Lord Elgin, in his letters, recalls him as Isaac Bey, who acts as his confidential secretary to Captain Pasha, has much acquaintance with European manners and language. Lady Elgin, whose letters are always much more fun to read, she's quite a giddy character, one feels. She says, Isaac Bey, the Pasha's great man, is 48. He has travelled all about for 18 years and speaks French perfectly. Remarkably polite, was in England for a few weeks. On his return from his travels, he was banished to one of the islands in the archipelago, that means Greek islands, and a man sent with him who had orders to hide his body and bring back his head. Fortunately for him, they were taken by Algerian pirates, and in this Sultan's time, he is in the highest regard. Now, if we look at Isaac a bit more, he was in fact an important companion of Selim during his confinement while his predecessor was in power, as was his tutor, Ebu Bekir Ratib Efendi, and please excuse my pronunciation of Turkish too. And of course, his closest companion was the Captain Pasha to be Kuyuk Hussein. It was indeed this Isaac who was Selim's messenger to Louis XVI in Paris, where he travelled in 1776 to 8, and in 1782 to 4, and in 1786 to 90, asking for cooperation against Russian and Austrian aggression. He's recorded as being on a boat with Charles Gouffier in 1784, and in 1785 he becomes involved in this port conflict between the Grand Vizier and the then Captain Pasha. That Captain Pasha is demoted and the Grand Vizier is arrested. There seems to have been some sort of plot to get rid of the Sultan and replace him with Selim. The result is that the Grand Vizier is taken off to an island, strangled, and his head brought back to Constantinople. Isaac seems to have escaped thanks to those pirates that Lady Elgin mentioned. The fact that he was in England for a couple of weeks, he was probably connected with a change of ambassadors in that country. Now, that's a lot about someone, but it's an important position in all of this, understanding how the connections went on. And there is amongst the drawings in Broom Hall in Lord Elgin's collection, this drawing of a card game. Now, the Elgin family believe it's a drawing by Lucieri and that it shows Lord Elgin and Lady Elgin playing cards with the Sultan. But this is, of course, impossible. The Sultan would never have had that sort of contact with foreigners, these wretched Franks. This was impossible. It was also impossible, essentially, for the Captain Pasha to have done the same. He did visit the embassy once, but that caused a sensation in Constantinople, and I'm sure, and he certainly never sat down to eat or do anything. So I think what we have here is the first image of Isaac Bey sitting, playing cards with Lord and Lady Elgin, accompanied on his right hand by J.P. Morier, who was one of Elgin's secretaries, who was brought up in Izmir and so had very good languages and able to explain things to him. But Isaac was well adjusted to the European tradition. Then another area was the ladies, what we might call now the back channel, that was a way for the Ottoman ports to communicate with some of these ambassadors and their families, because communication directly between the Sultan and any of these people was extremely difficult. It was always controlled and policed, in a sense. So this was a way, by making contact through the female sides of these groups, to have things done. And in fact, one of the connections is Lady Elgin was asked by the mother of the Sultan, through the wife of the Captain Pasha, to try and help get Lord Keith to give more troops and ships to help the Ottoman cause in Egypt. Adam mentioned the sarcophagus, and he tells me he thinks it's kitsch. We see it on the left. This was made from porphyry brought back by Lord Elgin, and Edem has very clearly put forward the process by which this was acquired. We have the documents down to the last detail, where the Sultan is rather sort of fed up with the process, had been asked for pieces of porphyry and marble, and just says, essentially, get on with it, do what he wants. And that's important in our understanding of all of this connection between antiquities, what we think of as archaeology, and the Ottomans, is that it had no particular interest or significance to them. It did have a value as they began to learn politically as a way to encourage and discourage these ambassadors. The Sogdiane relief, you see a view of two pieces that were taken under similar circumstances by Lord Elgin, a relief on the left, a basis for a tomb, and on the right, an inscription face upwards, which was heavily worn, and it was apparently at the time thought to help with rheumatism in particular, and members of the flock of the church, the people, would rub themselves, sit on it, and thus get better. We'll come across this sort of use of antiquities in superstitious, para-religious fashion as we go on. At the heart of it all, for understanding this, is that lost Firman, as it's been called, that it gave Lord Elgin's artists and men in Athens permission to excavate and take sculptures and other objects, other stones away. It's clear when we look at it and we see what happened that the Firman, although it is lost, it has not been found, the original Turkish, this is an Italian translation done at the time so that Hunt, who took it to Athens, could understand it and speak from it. We don't have the Turkish original, but it is clear from many different areas and aspects that it actually existed, and that what it did give permission to do was to excavate and to remove, but it did not give permission to remove the sculptures from the buildings, or at least that was not specified in the Firman, it would seem. That, of course, doesn't mean that permission wasn't given, it clearly was given on the spot. And I've put in at the side the key Ottomans who worked in this process, and the Celebi Mustafa Reşid Efendi was an important figure. He was extremely close to the Sultan, and part of the inner circle, a sort of kitchen cabinet, as it's been called, from 1792. The Kaymakam, of course, was the most important and senior person in the Ottoman port after the Sultan at this period, because the Grand Vizier was away on expedition in Egypt. The interesting, most interesting figure really is Mehmed Reşid Ağa, Mubashir, that means a bringer of good news. He was sent with Hunt and the British group to see that the Fearman was obeyed, to help them, but also to accompany Hunt, who was to go on to a tour of the Morea, and then a year later, Hamilton, who was touring in Egypt and central Greece as well as Athens. He was alongside them to help them, but also he has a sort of, I think, a military role. He has a spying role. He is looking not only at what the English are doing, but he is also looking at what is going on in Greece. So he is not just a simple facilitator. He has a real role for the Ottoman benefit. Now, the travelers are the biggest source of our information, and we can read them, but I think we need to read them with a certain amount of skepticism. I mean, in these days when we have what we talk of as fake news or alternative truth or even evidence-free claims, we have to assess as historians what they are saying and why they are saying it. I've begun to list the various travellers who have gone, and I haven't time, obviously, to talk about them all, but there seem to be phases of these journeys of people going out, and we'll see them after about 1810 increase exponentially. I'll concentrate first on these two characters, William Gell, or Gell, as I think I should pronounce it, William Gell and Edward Dodwell, who were out in Athens in 1801. They went back again in 1805, but they were there when Lord Elgin's men, Lucieri, his chief artist, and his assistants, were first approaching the Acropolis to excavate and then to remove objects from the Parthenon and other buildings. And so they are an important contemporary record, but their voices we have to be careful with. They are also artists, and so we get a pictorial image to go with the words of their publications, which we should note, although they were there in 1801, they didn't write it up and publish it until 1819. And much has happened, and there's been much interference in their memories and their presentations by that time. But it's interesting to see some of the images. We see on the top left William Gell's view of the corner of the Parthenon with only a ladder in place. This is a little sledge underneath one of the metopes. This is when the artists were doing work on the building in terms of drawing and molding before any removals were begun. The first step after the Fearman was excavation, and here we see I think it is Atkins, who was with Gell and Dodwell, depicting actual excavation going on and the finds being then drawn by Elgin's chief sculptural artist, Fyodor Ivanov. Dodwell, who was there with Gell and Atkins, his pictures all come from 1805, from the second visit. He kept records, clearly, of what happened in 1801, but his finished pictures are an amalgam of 1801 and 1805, and and of course, the imagination of an artist. And we have to be very careful for that reason. On the top right, the view of the Parthenon shows all of the metopes in place, and it was the metopes that were first removed by Lucieri. They're all in place, so that is telling us 1801, but the pedimental figures have gone, and so it is post-1805, so he is mixing periods. And also, of course, some of the small buildings, as on the bottom right slide, had been removed before the work got underway. And here we see, supposedly, a metope being lowered from the building. But again, this is an artist's vision of it. We know from contemporary sources that there were, in fact, 20 Greeks used in the process, as well as 5 crew members from the ship. It was a much more busy scene than the artist wishes to give us. Dodwell is also a source of the first reaction to Elgin's work, the first disapproval of it. But as I say, it's written in 1819, and so we must be very careful of it. Although it seems so accurate and explicit, it isn't always. And I quote you some. "During my first tour of Greece, I had the inexpressible mortification of being present when the Parthenon was despoiled of its finest sculptures, and when some of its architectural members were thrown to the ground." This is inaccurate. It has an effect in words, but it's not truly exactly accurate. "They were fixed between the triglyphs as in a groove, and in order to lift them up, it was necessary to throw to the ground the magnificent cornice by which they were covered." Again, no, that's not really true. There seems to be an occasion of only one falling to the ground. On many of these, in this area, there was no member above the metopes itself. What Lucieri's men did do, clearly, though, was to hack at the corners of the triglyphs, those triple elements between the metopes, in order to get the metopes out, because they had were overlapped by this, and the marble, after many years, tends to sort of merge together to seal itself, as other people who have removed metopes from temples have discovered, the first being, I think, Augustus on the Temple of Aphea and Aegina, where all the metopes were removed in exactly the same fashion, and we have no idea what they showed. And then, of course, the restorers, the modern restorers of the Parthenon, had the same problem when they wanted to remove the metopes. Dodwell goes on, "It's painful to reflect that these trophies of human genius, which had resisted the silent decay of time during a period of more than 22 centuries, which had escaped the destructive fury of the iconoclasts, the inconsiderate rapacity of the Venetians, and the barbarous violence of the Mohammedans, should have been doomed at last to experience the devastating outrage which will never cease to be deplored." Elgin's involvement. He goes on to admit, however, the advantages to the progress of the arts for England, but wishes that only antiquities that lay around or might be excavated were removed, and not things on buildings. So this is a perfectly, we think now, a reasonable division of what was done and not done. This wasn't something that was set in stone as a program. You only did this, you didn't do that, because essentially no one had been able in a position to remove things from buildings before, so the question had not come up. It's only afterwards we begin to see it being judged. My third long quote for him, furthermore, he says, "Nor have I any hesitation in declaring that the Athenians in general, nay, even the Turks themselves, did lament the ruin that was committed, and loudly and openly blamed their sovereign for the permission that he had granted. I was on the spot at the time and had opportunity of observing and indeed participating in the sentiment of indignation which such conduct universally inspired. The whole proceeding was so unpopular in Athens that it was necessary to pay the laborers more than their usual profits before any could be prevailed upon to assist in this work of profanation." Remember, this was written in 1819, and that is after the collection of Lord Elgin had arrived in London and had been acquired for the British Museum. In talking about some of those things, he comments on the wages. And again, you think, oh gosh, yes, Lucieri is bribing with high wages. Well, it seems very clear that he would have had to pay high wages to get people to work such hard physical work, lifting and moving sculptures. It was dangerous in case they fell, as these were big weights they were dealing with. And so to pay high wages, one would expect to have to do. But we find it very difficult to judge, you know, is this true or not? Not least because a later source, a contemporary Greek source, Benizelos, who we come to later, notes that in 1799, 1800, the city was very calm and peaceful, and there was a huge input of influx of people, and prices had soared, and that prices had quadrupled or quintupled at that period. So what relation that has to paying workers more is very difficult for us now to look back and assess. He also gives this impression that there was a continued revolt amongst both Greeks and Turks at what was being done. And it's important for us now to try and think, can we find that? Is it reliable comment, or and can we find these sorts of people? Of course, Dodwell and Gell had other problems with Lucieri, as we shall see. And again, there's an edge to what he is saying that is a personal conflict. As I say, this only began to be written and shown and published in 1819, but we do in fact have a document of 1803 in something called the Gentleman's Magazine, a collection of comments by everyone everywhere, which was avidly read by everyone in Britain. And in this document, an anonymous letter is written to the editor from Rome, it would seem, in August. And the person who's writing it has seen Lord Elgin's team, who've come back now, left Athens, passing through Rome before they go to their own cities. And so it's an interesting comment at that moment. The writer records that Elgin did receive permission to remove and ship off whatever suited him. Again, a confirmation of this permission. But it must be owned they afterwards made such good use of the opportunity afforded them that future travellers will not be much inclined to bless the memory of Lord Elgin. In other words, again, this is a sense of exceeding what was allowed. And it goes on to say, this may be considered the last gleaning of what had been spared by the successive spoilers of the ornaments of Greece. Not only have all movable works been carried away, but many things which had been considered hitherto immovable have been torn away from their places where they had remained unmolested for thousands of years. Who was this mystery voice in Rome in 1803? I think the answer, given the sort of the style of the writing, was Dodwell, who was in Rome in 1803 and may well have concocted this letter to Gentleman's Magazine. The relationship between Dodwell and Gell is difficult to understand, but they seem very much to have operated together and in tandem. They were great friends. Lucieri, writing in 1805 in Athens, says that Gell has been stirring up trouble against him in Athens. He persuaded the French here, he says, with whom he and all the others share their pleasures, that the ambassador, it's not Elgin, but his successor, Drummond, is completely opposed to the works I have carried out, and for that reason he doesn't little to protect them. This charming talk has reached the ears of the voivode, who has stopped me from continuing to dig. Again, Drummond, the succeeding ambassador, was Gell's personal friend. So there is a, you know, there are issues and manoeuvres going on. And finally, oddly, while Elgin was in detention in Paris in 1805, having been arrested on the way back from Greece as war overtook him, he says he received a letter from an anonymous Englishman traveller complaining of Lucieri taking down part of the frieze of the Parthenon. Immediately, he was taken into close confinement, away from his family, and then taken to Melun. This was surely, I think, the doing of Gell and Dodwell singly or together, this sending of an anonymous letter, which then affects the dealing with Elgin in Paris. So it's a complex story. Whatever one feels about what was done, we are trying to understand how people were reacting at the time. Another figure is E.D. Clarke, the Reverend E.D. Clarke, who was out in 1801, at the end of 1801, after Gell and Dodwell. And he met the Elgins in Constantinople before going on to Greece. He was a tutor for a traveling rich boy. And as they came back across the Aegean Islands from, he'd been in Egypt and in the Holy Land before coming to Athens, he stopped on Patmos and collected a large group of manuscripts, one of them called now the Clarke Plato, and is the oldest surviving manuscript of Plato's Tetralogies 1-6, and probably the first volume of a pair of volumes. And we know it's dated to AD 895, so it's a very early and very important piece. These acquisitions were done in the usual fashion, with a bit of purchase and with a bit of putting things under your cloak. And he got away with some very fine manuscripts, which he later sold to the Bodleian Library in Oxford. He had also formed a collection of marbles, which were given to Cambridge, who then gave him an honorary doctorate. This is the sort of manipulation, again, for personal benefit. These manuscripts were to be later condemned, the removal of them from Patmos were to be condemned by Adamantinos Korais explicitly. And that's the first reference to, in Korais's work, to displeasure at the removal of part of Greek heritage. Clarke was in Athens, and he reports, again, I quote for you, the removal of a metope from the Parthenon lifted. The adjoining masonry was loosened, and down came the fine masses of Pentelican marble, scattering their white fragments with thundering noise amongst the ruins, so that the Dizdar, the chief on the Acropolis, actually took the pipe from his mouth, letting fall a tear, said in the most emphatic tone of voice, "Telos, stop." Now, this dramatically charged account presents us, as historians trying to assess it, with some difficulties. For two metopes were removed while Clarke was in Greece, but both were actually taken down while he was away on a trip in the Morea. He was on the Acropolis on the 4th of November, and could have seen the preparations for the removal of one, but he doesn't mention that at all. He's more concerned in writing at this point about his embarrassment of having gone into a hammam during ladies' hour, as it were, and caused a scandal in the city and feared for his life, all of these ramifications of doing something like that. So we have to be very careful when we read these accounts. They're dramatizing things that happened or may have happened, and things can be got wrong and overemphasized. And we can begin to judge Clarke from his contemporary letters to his friend William Otter, rather than his published account later, and where in which he makes no mention whatsoever of this particular story or event. He's upset at what is going on, the removal of the reliefs, but has no particular story like this. And we get the feeling that this is very much his creation, and something he really liked, because he wrote to Lord Byron later about it and gave him the full story, which is then republished by Lord Byron. Clark removed a large sculpture from Eleusis, of which we know a great deal about. It had been seen for many years before. It's been clearly defaced by Christians early on. It was buried up to its shoulders in dung, and the local population believed that by putting their manure next to the statue of Ceres, the goddess of the crops, would improve its efficacy and would make things better. Okay. When he's trying to remove it, he gets the local clergyman to strike the first blow, getting rid of the dung. And this is a nice interaction between the clergy and the locals. I must move on rapidly. Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. I've got far too much to say, as usual. These sort of accusers circled around Lord Elgin with these stories, and there was a great deal of talk amongst travellers and in Britain on this sort of area. I won't go on any further about it. It's a complex scenario to understand. Interesting to turn to two architects who visited Athens when Lucieri was working, and judge their reactions and also see what they produced once they got home. Robert Smirke on the left was very upset at the removal of some of the blocks over the frieze. But William Wilkins says, well, actually, there's no real effect on the traveler visiting it. You won't notice anything. And when I was there, I didn't see anything disturbing. So you get different voices, different extremes. And again, one has to think out why. Fauvel, of course, is the person that Lucieri in Athens was in competition with, and we can begin to put together quite a bit about Fauvel, and Alessia Zamboy in the audience has written a wonderful book on Fauvel and his time and what he did. And I just show you elements of Fauvel having a cup of coffee, supposedly in front of his easel. There are two cups of coffee, one presumably for the artist painting as well as himself. We see his house has been found by the American excavations. The consulate was somewhere different, and we see it in the centre on the lower screen. And a rather charming view by Dupré of a lady in an Athenian dress, who I think is Mariana Rock, seen from the upstairs of the consulate out over the door into the passaporta, into the Roman agora. Choiseul Gouffier, this is a difficult story, and I don't really have time to go into it. He was interested in acquiring sculptures and collection, and made, in fact, a large collection, and he acquired pieces from the Parthenon, sometimes in rather dubious circumstances, sometimes perfectly clearly. Again, Edem has looked at what documents there are in the Ottoman archives as to what sort of permissions he has. And again, there's some information, but we are missing other pieces of information. Captain Truge on the right came to Athens with Lady Craven, and she records the attempt to remove a metope from the building itself. Whether this is accurate reporting or not is again an issue, but he was clearly there. It's the same sort of proto version of what Elgin was doing. 1810, we see an explosion really of travellers into this area. And I've listed as many as I could think of, but I'm sure I've missed a great deal of them. There was a slight hiatus in this visiting when, of course, Napoleon was on the loose again and before the Battle of Waterloo, and then it settled down again afterwards. Of these people, one should remember Lord Byron. This is Lord Byron had taken against Elgin and his collection before he ever went to Athens. He saw it in its temporary display in Park Lane, and gives a description of what he sees in a publication in 1809, before he goes to Greece. He says, "Let Aberdeen and Elgin," that's Lord Aberdeen, "still pursue the shade of fame through regions of virtu, waste useless thousands on their Phidian freaks, misshapen monuments and maimed antiques, and make their grand saloons a general mart for the all mutilated blocks of art." Byron, again, is wonderfully eloquent of what is going on, we will find, but he is a satirist, and he is an angry satirist, we must remember. He then went to Athens with his close friend Hobhouse, and there Byron had his first interaction with antiquity and the Parthenon. Hobhouse was a different character altogether. How they got on together, I haven't a clue. It must have been a very strange relationship. Hobhouse immediately went out looking at everything, writing hundreds of notes. He was really interested in understanding about the antiquities, and he also had interest in the local Greeks and Turks. Byron was not. He immediately sat down on a column drum near the Temple of Zeus and started to write Childe Harold, his next poem. He actually only went on the Acropolis once. We think of him being there for months and months, and he never went up more than once because he had a bad leg, and climbing or walking were very difficult for him. So we hear of him riding around elsewhere in Attica, but not onto the Acropolis. So it's these things we need to bear in mind. Hobhouse, though, is a very interesting figure who tries to summarize some of the issues that we have begun to see, trying to discuss the basic questions. Would the objects have been destroyed if they had not been removed by Elgin? Would the French have removed them if they had had the chance? And so he is speculating on these different scenarios. And I won't go any further than just to say that this footnote that he writes this in is interesting to read, but again, one has to read it with caution. Hobhouse also talks about superstition, and we will have superstition, I think, come in later, so perhaps I should exclude some of the ideas about superstition and the idea that it represents a proto-archaeology. Personally, I tend to think of it as a para-religion. It is a belief system that has nothing to do with archaeology, because archaeology, in a sense, did not exist, and we don't have to have it invented earlier. I wanted to show you some more of the people, because for me it's always the images and the objects that are of interest. The voivode on the left is the character who was there when Lord Elgin's firman was presented and raised no objection whatsoever to what he was doing. On the right, in the top, you see the Dizdar on the Acropolis, the man in red robes. He seems to have been a fairly violent and rapacious type, he's recorded as, and no doubt he made huge profit from all of Elgin's work. Below, we see a view of the Voivode Lykla, where the voivode's offices were behind the Hadrian's Library, in a wonderful series of views that I think were taken from Logothetes's house. Voivodes and Dizdars and bishops, we begin to see the interaction between these groups over some monuments that were destroyed, such as the temple by the Ilissos, the blocks of which were in fact sold to the bishop of Athens to begin to build a new church for himself. Not as is usually assumed, was just lost when Hagi Haseki, the voivode, built walls around Athens. The process had begun before that in a complicit action between the Ottoman and the Orthodox Church. And of course, on the right, a block from the Erechtheum taken down by the Dizdar and put in front of the entrance to the Acropolis with a Turkish inscription on it. Also, we think of the destruction that was going on, and we hear again and again they were destroying the antiquities when we were there. And it's very easy for commentators now to say, oh, this is imagined, this is exaggerated, this is not true, if that's what they want to say. But if we really look at what was going on, this cannot be doubted. We have again and again information about, for example, the Turks making tombstones out of antiquities. Here, a nice column drum that's being reshaped, as it were. And the use of cannonballs, marble cannonballs, is something we never really think about. There was a huge demand for marble cannonballs to fire from the cannons. They were lighter than iron, and iron, of course, was much harder to get hold of. There was plenty of marble around to make these sort of weapons. And in fact, old marble was better than fresh marble because it exploded on contact and caused more havoc and demolition. There's a wonderful passage. I mean, this is something that covers the whole of the Ottoman world. It's not just Athens, but it's everywhere. And we see it in the Troad as well, where one traveller stays with a Turkish mason who had his livelihood turning things into cannonballs. The damage on the Parthenon is there too, and is incontrovertible. When it was done and who it was done by is a whole different topic. But we should notice, for example, the cast of one block of the frieze made in 1686 or 7 by Fauvel, and the state it was in when Lord Elgin acquired it. And if we look a bit further back from the middle of the 18th century onwards, there were huge losses to the pediment figures as well as to frieze slabs. So the process was ongoing destruction. What did the Lucieri and his team make of all of this? Elgin seems to have felt no compunction whatsoever what was going on. He had done things the right way, and he was doing this to save antiquity. Lucieri was much more aware of what was going on. He was doing it, and he clearly showed remorse at some of the things he'd had to do. But again, it's not the whole thing. It's just when there were occasional mishaps. The removal of the caryatid was one of the great cause célèbre. Amongst the local clergy, we find once Elgin starts his process, the bishop gives him and his relatives presents. And this is an exchange of presents, but it is, in a sense, saying the church saying, these are of no particular interest to us. We know they are of particular interest to you, and we give them to you. Logothete, who was the British consul there, also gave things to Lord Elgin. He was a Greek, a long ancient family, Archontes rulers, but he gave things, especially at the moment when Lucieri had started to take things off the building, and there was the Dizdar was clearly upset, but so was Logothete at what was going on. He felt it was doing too much. Then he stood back and said, oh, well, no, it's okay. And to make up for it, he gave presents to Lord Elgin. The lone, the single Greek voice that one finds at this person, at this moment, is someone called Yannis Benizelos, who is a teacher in Athens, in the school, the Decca school. And he was he's a very interesting figure who one would like to spend more time looking at. He was an author of several of various documents. They were never published, but he was a historian and trying to assess the history of Athens, especially the modern history, which was becoming more of interest to them. But he has nothing in his text that has anything to do with the monuments. This was outside their interests or their educational system to understand the context of any philosopher that they might happen to read the text of. But in this passage at the end there, of a letter written in 1803 to John Hawkins, who was a visitor earlier. It's very interesting to see this. He's thanking Hawkins for 100 piastres because the school was going downhill and there was no financing, and various travellers helped. And he says at the end of it that it's much to be... he says the Turks are quiet and they do no damage or ill to the Greeks. Almost all of the power rests in the hands of the Greeks. A great peace and security reigns. And this is giving us some idea of what the local Greek population was like and what it could do and where it was. He describes increases in prices, but he ends his letter with, "Nevertheless, one thing would make you not a little sad, as it does all those who have some idea of these things. The last deplorable stripping of the temple of Athena on the Acropolis and of the other relics of antiquity, like a noble and wealthy bride who has lost all her jewelry and finery. Oh, how we Athenians should remember this event, and how much praise and admiration we owe to the ancient heroes of Rome, Pompey and Hadrian, when we look on these things." It's that phrase, "all those who have some idea of these things," that rings in one's mind when one reads it. It is telling us of what is essentially, I think, a rather desperate isolation. He saw what was going on was wrong and bad for Greek heritage. His colleagues didn't. And this was no doubt the result of poor education. There were only two schools in Athens. The one he taught at, the Deca School and the Seminary of Greek Studies. These were going downhill fast with financial problems. Elgin bought two pieces from the seminary, which had already closed. And we see outside Athens the voices of the Greek regeneration, especially someone like Chorais, who realizes the problem of the removal of antiquities, wants to do something about it, talks about setting up a museum. He talks about the clerk having removed manuscripts, and he wants to set up a museum on Chios, which might have been a disaster given later objects, but anyway. And we see people like... Chorais was living in Paris, so none of our travellers had any contact with him, and what he was saying was only getting to anyone in Athens in the form of books that he wrote, and so there was little real connection. Psalidas in Yanina was much closer and was seen by most travellers who came that route south from northern Europe. He made comments about the sculptures which ring with us now and have been said by others. He's quoted as, "You English are carrying off the works of the Greeks, our forefathers. Preserve them well. We Greeks will come and redemand them." This appears in a number of visitors going through. But Psalidas was clearly a very acerbic figure, and none of the, certainly British visitors liked him much, but none of the people who are resident in Yanina, such as Pukvil even, or Leek, seem to have had much contact with him. And it must have something to do with his acerbic character. And one reads the name Psalidas, which in Greek means scissors, and one feels, as they say in Greece, onoma ke pragma. He wasn't a pleasant character, though he was an incredibly intelligent one. I end with just the question. This is the end, don't worry. This is the end. The younger generation, who was left? Who took things on? And we have three figures. Alexandros Logotheti, the son of the Logotheti who'd been in cahoots with Lucieri and with the Ottomans. Yanis Mamouratouris, who was of Albanian origin and got on very well with Byron, taught him Greek, wrote him a poem, all sorts of things. And Petros Revalakis. Now, all three of these signed up and created the Philomouzos Eteria, a society in 1813 which had particular interests in education and in also beginning to collect books for a library and into being involved with archaeology and antiquities and serving as a museum for pieces that are found. And we begin to find that travellers, as they had said they wanted anything for this museum that the travellers couldn't take home, and we find that gifts are being given by travellers to the Philomousos Eteria, to the first museum, as they called it, in Athens, including Thomas Bergen, who we will hear about later. He gave a piece to this museum, as it first was. And these characters, or at least Mamaturis and Revalakis, were also part of the Philiki Eteria, which was a political, aggressive society aiming at freedom for the Greeks. It is Revalakis who is the interesting one at the end. He was complicit with the travellers. He helped them excavate. He seems to have acted as an inspector of sites, keeping, perhaps as we begin to understand, an eye on them for the Eteria. He also collected and excavated on his own land, and we see on the bottom right a piece that, lost piece, that he had found and was drawn and kept. And once one comes back to this idea of the total complicity of Athenian society, with the leading people and the church being complicit with the Ottomans in Constantinople. But how else were these people to learn about archaeology and the importance of their heritage without actually working alongside the travellers and learning about what we call archaeology from them in order to put it back into the idea of protecting Greek heritage? I'm sorry I've gone on so long.
Thank you, Dr. I think you underestimated the idea.